guys like that 30 seconds before the landslide, somebody has to get hit with lightning, and then 5 minutes before that, the flood comes. Here we go. Yeah, we have a commercial here right off the bat. Hey, George. Feel like hitting out a few fly balls here. Good morning. You'll find that I have a tendency to be very dangerous on Saturdays. Saturday is a dangerous day. Hi, George. I'm walking along 49th Street now more than 10 minutes ago, and I feel it in the air already. It's just Saturday. That's all. Saturday is the dime store day. I don't know why that is. Saturday is a dime store day. It's as though the whole world has a dark maroon kind of mahogany woodwork. And there's that dime store smell in the air. All that dime store candy and, you know, all that stuff in the dime store. Have you been in the dime store recently? Or do you call it the five and dime? Or is it the five and ten to you? Well, in the Midwest, it's called the dime store. And in the dime store these days, of course, there's more shouting than anything else goes on in dime stores. You can't hear. Your ears are jiggling constantly. There's the sound of a guy saying, "Step out right up, ladies and gentlemen. In just a few moments, we're going to begin to give away these wonderful ballpoint pens. Now, of course, our only object in giving these away is to make sure that many people are using them so that other people will see them, and they will be on the market very shortly. They will be on the market very shortly, and when they get on the market, ladies and gentlemen, they will cost over $7.95. However, for those of you who are fortunate enough to be here at this time, fortunate enough to be right here at this very moment, we are going to make these pens available to you absolutely as a gift. Absolutely as a gift. Now, of course, to show your good faith, we're going to require a nominal payment, a payment that just pays for the advertising of this beautiful, wonderful ballpoint pen that writes forever, that continues to have a beautiful, easy, smooth working point for years and years on end. We will also include with this pen an ever-sharpening paring knife, an ever-sharpening paring knife with a non-burnable plastic handle. Now, step right up. Have you noticed when these guys are doing this, when they're trying to gather a tip, as Long John would call it, they don't look out at the crowd. They're looking down. They're rearranging all their stuff all the time as though they're busy. This is all part of the technique, you know. They're very businesslike. Ladies and gentlemen, now step right up. For those of you who have been fortunate enough to be here at this time, you're going to find yourself going home with a wonderful... Ladies and gentlemen, step right up. You know, shuffling things back and forth. And I'm over there trying to buy myself some jelly beans. Ladies and gentlemen, I hear the sound of this roar, and by George, I'm back home again. The world is a gigantic skin game. And there's just two kinds of people. There are the people who skin, and then there are the people who get skinned. And I suppose being one or the other is no more fun than being the other, because the guy who gets skinned invariably feels that he's gotten a good deal. And the guy who does the skinning invariably feels he's gotten a good deal. And as a matter of fact, all of us are, in the end, in the total ultimate end, here to be skinned anyway. And so it really doesn't make any difference. It's just the little momentary victories here and there, you know. Like the other day, I'm walking on 38th Street, you know. The world is a kind of a... Well, I've often wondered just how much of what we see, how much of what we think, and how much of what we dream and put together is a kind of projection of an image of what we want things to be. And things never are, actually. I'm walking on 38th Street, way over on the west side, and oh, this is real fist fighting neighborhood over there. I mean, you know, this is a real neighborhood over there, see. And I'm walking along there, and here's this tumble down old building. It's about four stories high, and on the bottom level there, there's an old, what looks like an ex hardware shop that's been deserted 50 years ago now, and it's full of old barrels and stuff, and the windows are dirty, and so on. There's 50 kids running in and out, and, you know, the whole business, and you can hear a couple of people having a fight on a second floor. It's going on, and it's just one of these Babel, you know, tower-type things, and it's all sort of sinking in the ground, and on the ground floor, there's a little sign, neatly lettered, that says, "Penthouse for Rent." A penthouse for rent. And I could just see some guy renting this penthouse for about $4 a month. And it's this, you know, chimneys, all clotheslines, chicken coops, pigeon roosts and everything all around him. He's living in his penthouse, and he's writing back home to Ohio. Yes, Mother, I'm not here in New York more than 2 weeks, and already I'm living in a penthouse. Yeah, sit down there, will you? Oh, yes, we have a commercial here for Boneless Chuck Pot Roast. Boneless Chuck Pot Roast sounds like at least five guys that I've worked with. I'm sorry. You all missed that. Boneless Chuck Pot Roast sounds like at least five salesmen that I've worked with in the past 5 years. Hi, Chuck. How are you out there? Oh, Chuck Pot Roast. Boneless as they come. His mother used to call him spineless. Of course, this is a new world. Boneless Chuck Pot Roast. Look to your A&P supermarket for outstanding values every day of the week. For example, one of this week's many money-saving meat specials is on A&P's super right quality boneless Chuck Pot Roast. You'll find old Chuck down there in the meat department, sale priced at only 65 cents a pound. And he's boneless, with no fat added. The fat that he has been with him for years. So you pay only for the meat that comes to your table. You get A&P's famous super right quality Chuck, cut from grain-fed steer beef, and every roast is cut and trimmed to A&P's exacting standards. So drop in and see old boneless Chuck Pot Roast at only 65 cents the pound at your nearby A&P supermarket in nearby New Jersey and in greater New York. That's opposed to lesser New York. No A&P's there. It's like the first time I found out that there was a greater auk. That's A-U-K. That's a word for you to look up. And now while you're looking up that word, we will move on to the mysterious, sinister city of Philadelphia. As a matter of fact, as you know, a crack is appearing in the outskirts of Philadelphia that has defied all expert analysis. And in fact, it has swallowed up already several bystanders. Including one PR man who came there as the result of attempting to make the thing look like something that it wasn't. He is gone now, into the bowels of the earth. Incidentally, speaking of the bowels of the earth, I'll never forget one time I'm a kid saying, you know, kids, think about what is under there, what is under there, under the ground. Most adults, as they get older and walk around, by the way, we're going to start a program of adult education. Here on this program, you know, we're always talking about kids, you know, what kids should read and all that stuff. And from the letters that I've read from the kids, they don't need any education. I mean, they're 4 miles ahead of their old man, most of them. As a matter of fact, you know, it is interesting that more young people, you get out to the paper book gallery, this is not a commercial, so don't write that. You get out to the paper book gallery or any good place where they're selling paper books these days, and you will find that the average age of the person standing around and buying books of exceedingly interesting quality is roughly about 19. This is intriguing. And where do you find the old man? You find the old man in some place buying a magazine called Whoopee. You know, with the center fold out with the chick made out of paper. And, you know, this whole business, either that or you will find him getting the latest copy of the Reader's Digest. Really, there's something that happens. I don't know whether these people who read this tripe, don't go... Oh, tripe is now a very, very sinister word. I do not know whether or not the people who read this mediocre stuff, whether they started out reading good stuff and went downhill or what, or whether reading this trivia is a step up for them. I can't tell which it is. I'd like to know that the countless people who spend their hours reading things like The Duchess of Windsor Tells All, you know, this kind of thing, or how does Cary Grant continue to stay so young even though he's 104? This kind of, it makes me pop out in hives. And I hear these people constantly on the radio recommending that you read this stuff. They say, oh, there's a wonderful article in this week's Whoopie Doopie magazine, and it's a wonderful, wonderful, our ladies, you're going to just want to read it. It's about how Marilyn Monroe had a big argument with Pandit Nehru. It's called, and it's a dialogue, like the other day I'm hearing, it's a dialogue between Marilyn Monroe and Pandit Nehru. Wonderful, wonderful, it's just terrific. And then there's a wonderful article on the spring fashions. And you know, talking about the spring fashions, we are so shot full of hypocrisy, I don't think we know which end is up. The other day I'm looking at the New York Times. No, seriously, I'm very intrigued by this quality of double talk that we all live with. I can remember just a few years ago. Now, listen, you don't keep writing. Listen for a minute. I can remember just a few semesters ago. What are you people writing in there? For heaven's sakes, more writing's going on here. I'm always suspicious of people who, when they listen to you, they write. You know, I expect any minute now to get a phone call. Would you please give me your serial number? You want my serial number? 1609-8946. There it is. My rank? Of course you know what my rank is. You can see it in my eyes. I can't hide my rank. But the thing is that I'm very intrigued by this quality of double talk. Now here, I don't know whether you saw it in the New York Times a couple of days ago. And to me, the biggest, and this is no commercial, I am not connected in any way, shape, or form with the Times, but the biggest nickel, I'm always surprised that I get a Times for a nickel. I mean, that is an incredible buy, you know that? You get the whole panoply, the whole ridiculousness of it all, you know, poured into one big thing there. I'm chuckling from one end to the other of the Times. and in many ways that I shouldn't be, I suppose. The ponderous pronouncements of the critics and the... You know, you get this great, it's a funny thing. It's as though there's the lesser breed of people. Have you ever wondered whether or not the people who write official things are really actually bigger than you are? It wouldn't surprise me at all if Brooks Atkinson were 35 feet tall. Seriously, you know, a big concrete shoe is walking and look down upon the poor scrabblings of us lesser mortals grumbling along on our knees there trying to make the best of all possible worlds turn into the most easily livable of all possible worlds. But nevertheless, I'm going along there seeing them. I come across this page of fashions. And listen to this. This is the way it went. I'll paraphrase it. Speaking of tripe, this is WORAM&FM New York, and we will be here till just before the opera. They put a cushion between me and the opera now. Chicken, O-R, chicken. Can't take it. But I'm going through the Times the other day, and I'm sitting in the bus, and I come across this page of fashions. Now, this is not a program where anybody's going to sit around and talk about whether women's fashions are ridiculous or not. This is not at all what I'm here to do. And it doesn't matter a whit to me. What does interest me, though, however, is the interesting kind of double talk that we constantly indulge ourselves in. For example, I remember just a few years ago, like, say, 1958. I'm not talking about 5,000 years ago. They used to talk about the fashions of the 20s as being boyish. And as being anti-feminine, they said that the boyish fashions of the 1920s were a new low in rotten, ridiculous fashions. This is what they used to say a couple of years ago. And when people went to parties and tried to be funny, they would wear something from the 20s. This was considered very, 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 very funny type stuff to wear. Absolutely flat, no, nothing. Just straight line, nothing. Just ridiculous little things, see? And if there's anything that is anti-feminine, it is the fashion attitude of the 1920s, or was, I should say. It flattens out everything, and anything that was there is not there. You know what I mean? Do I have to draw pictures here? Okay. So here's what happened, see. Now, that was in about 58, they were all 59, all the way up to 60, they would say this. And in fact, there used to be an occasional article, boy, do you remember the ridiculous stuff they wore in the 20s? Ha, ha, ha. That kind of tongue-in-cheek stuff. Well, here's what happens. I'm going through there, and here is a page of pictures of fashions right out of the 20s. It says Juan Balenciaga, or whatever his name is, surprised the entire fashion world yesterday with his new show. His new show consisted of actual patterns copied from the 1920s with no changes, nothing. He reproduced the 1920s fashions from old patterns and surprised the fashion world. The thing that was particularly stunning about these new fashions was that they are now ultra-feminine. Superb, ultra-feminine, and the beautiful, it brings out all the feminine, blah, blah, ultra-feminine, feminine. I said, what are you talking about? It's quite the opposite. And I guess it depends on what you call feminine. And then again, it's the double talk. And I can assure you, the same person who was writing this was writing quite the opposite of that 1 year ago or the year before, whenever they wrote about the 20s. Now, this is just a tiny... Who cares about fashions? I am saying this is true in spades in almost every other area of human endeavor. This ability to completely reverse your field, which of course is very convenient, because then you're always au courant. I mean, you're always with whatever is around. And you are never. And one of the really difficult things, of course, that must be faced by everyone who is attempting to make any kind of a plunk in public life, is that you never want to be caught saying whatever is hip at this moment isn't hip, because that makes you sort of unhip. You know, you say, "Oh, come on, that's a miserable picture." And what do you mean, miserable picture? That's the new wave. He says, "Yeah, new wave. They just used to call it out of focus photography." A couple of years ago, "Oh, no, 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 you can't, you don't understand. I mean, this is a serio-tragedrama." Oh, serio-tragedrama. Come on, will you get off my back? I mean, it's like everybody makes movies starting out with no story, and they work awfully hard to try to find one somewhere. In fact, you know that I know one of the big hit movies started out, in case you're interested. Are you interested in the behind-the-scenes stories of movies? I mean, really? The kind of stuff that Hedda Hopper never tells? Well, I'll tell you what happened. I know a producer who had about $3.5 million in the kick. And that means dough. And so he had no story, see? He had nothing, no material. But he had a star. So this star, who was a very, very big name, went out and rounded up 3 or 4 other stars. And they sat around and they had a couple of drinks. And one of them says, "Let's do a Western." He says, "Okay, let's do a Western." And so they knew where they could rent a Western set. And so they went out to the Western set, and the guy says, "I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll get on the horse, and I'll ride into town." And so they started to photograph the thing, and they photographed 98 million feet of film. They edited it down, and now they got the first existentialistic Western. No story at all. They just said, "Well, I'll tell you what you do now. You walk through that door, and you look for the sheep rancher's daughter." And in short, it was all ad-libbed. Nothing wrong with ad-libbing, except that the point is you have to have a point around which you ad-lib. I mean, ad-libbing per se. And so you see that. Did you ever hear this? You know, it's funny how I think about 98% of the people are cowed. By cowed, I mean they are impressed by any kind of achievement, because most people don't achieve anything. And they're fantastically impressed by a guy that does anything. And so... Anybody that makes a little movie or writes a little itty-bitty play or anything like this is very, very impressive to them. I know a guy who wrote a play once in 1932. He has been making a fortune on the lecture circuit ever since, lecturing about plays to ladies in the Kiwanis Club and the B'nai B'rith and so on. His play ran for about 4 days in the Provincetown Playhouse. And he's in all the anthologies now, as mentioned there, you see. And he makes this a tremendous thing. People are just impressed by anybody that does anything. If you ever designed a sled or if you ever flew a kite, did you know that I knew the guy who once held the endurance kite record for the state of Indiana? He flew a box kite for over 17 weeks. Never brought it down, rain or shine, stood out there in the field. This is a fact. And for a long while, he was a celebrity around Indiana. Then, you know, box kites went out of fashion, and poor guy's been trying to make a comeback. Tried yo-yos for a while. Sat on the top of a flagpole for a couple of months. Nothing happened, you know. Do you remember when they used to take off in airplanes and fly around fields for 16 weeks? Do you remember that? With a big question mark on the side. It says, 59th straight day. I mean, no one quite knew what it was all about or why, but the point is these guys are flying around up there. And I remember my old man, he was a sucker for this kind, a real patsy for this. Wherever anybody was roller skating on one foot, he had to go and see him. And I went to more hippodromes. Do you ever go to a hippodrome? I mean, my eardrums are still jiggling once in a while from the hippodrome. He took me to this place where they had, it was like a bowl, a wooden bowl thing. Now, these are the things that would be very difficult to explain to giraffes. Probably even chipmunks. Of course. I'm a kid. Let me tell you, the first time I'm a little kid, see? And they used to broadcast the dance marathons on the radio. You did? Well, I'm a kid, see? I'm just a little squirt. And every day at 12:30, my mother had to listen to the dance marathon. And the announcer would say, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking to you from Mickey Eisley's ballroom on the outskirts of South Chicago, where the Great White Way meets Lake Michigan. We're at White City, where the dance marathon, which is now going on under the jurisdiction of Mickey Eisley, it's now in its 423rd day. Jackie and Whoopi, the weeding team, have just completed a fantastic sprint of 17 straight minutes of jitterbugging. You can probably still hear the crowd cheering. And they have collected $600 in sprint money. The standings right now are couple number 41, Jackie and Whoopi, are in the lead with 7,922 points. The second couple, number 22, Fred and Myrtle, are in the second spot. Yes, now they've just, they're making a change on the scoreboard there. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the score now, yes, Fred and Myrtle are now being scored with 6,923 and a half points, ladies and gentlemen. They have just added 2¾ points to Fred and Myrtle's scoring. And in third place is... in third place is Mickey, and, Junie there in third place. The wonderful new couple that have just joined us, and they've done such great job, ladies and gentlemen, in the sprints. They are now in third place. They're the Wonder Team, the Dark Horse Team from Blue Island, Illinois, representing Harold's Bowling Alley. They're now in third place with 5,923 and a quarter points. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we are just about to begin a sprint. The orchestra is tuning up. If you can listen carefully in the background, would you please correct the PA system there? We have a little feedback. We will return you to our main studios until we have the technical difficulties under correction. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, before we return you, Jackie and Myrtle are in the lead with 7,923 points. This is the Dance Marathon returning you to our main studio. Take it away, main studio. The Dance Marathon will return to you as soon as we have our technical difficulties under correction there. Ladies and gentlemen... And I'm a kid, of course. This sort of thing scars you for life, you know. You begin to wonder about the total texture of the society in which you have been placed. And so, as a big gift on my birthday, my old man and the whole crowd of us went down. See, I've got technical difficulties on feedback. It's catching. You know, I know a guy who died of inverse feedback. Terrible thing. He just sat there and hummed away. he was just a mere shadow of himself. But I remember they took me down there on my birthday to see the dance marathon. And of course, it was considered a big surprise for me. And it's awkward, you know, when you're a kid, you have to pretend you're surprised a good deal of the time. And you have to also pretend that you're very happy a good deal of the time. Like when Aunt Min comes, you have to make with the thing, you know, and she has to come over and kiss you. I had an aunt who had a mustache. And she never shaved very closely. And every time she would kiss me, I would get it in the left ear. It was, you know, very embarrassing. And then I had an uncle who insisted on always kissing me too, you know. And he was a cigar smoker. And he'd come over, pow, on the left ear all the time. My ear got bigger and bigger and softer until the rutabagas growing in it, the whole vines, the whole stuff. And so I'm down there watching the marathon dance. And it was a wild time. I'll never forget it. This is one of the scenes that is emblazoned, you know? Like some guys have great scenes of enormous battles in World War II emblazoned. I don't remember anything of the war, really. But I sure remember the dance marathon. Oh, there's a trio sitting down at the end, way down there, and this is cheesy dance hall. And they had a stands kind of built around it. Like a little, a little amphitheater. And the large fat ladies are sitting around eating popcorn. And short, squat men drinking near beer. And everyone's sitting around there. And there's guys walking up and down selling souvenirs and stuff. And in the middle, here were these people all sort of moving around. By the way, the same people who watch dance marathons are the same crowd that go to roller derbies. This is all kind of a substrata. They go to roller derbies and they go to wrestling. You know, it's the same crew. Yeah. Yeah, the whole business. Oh, yeah, but it's an interesting thing. And they go to midget auto races, and they all the and stock car races, you know, all this. It's a very interesting substrate of humanity. I think it's a special. Actually, I think really it's a breed within a breed. I don't think sociologists really investigated man closely enough, because there are many breeds within breeds. And so here's the roller. Later, of course, they were roller derby crews. And also they go to pro basketball. Some of them. It's very, you know, and they get all excited over this. And I remember the big team from Blue Island, Illinois, was having an enormous sprint against the team from Harvey, Illinois. And everyone wore these silk shirts. You remember those, the funny things? And I'm a kid, see, I'm sitting there, and my father and my mother are all excited and hollering, "Come on, Jackie, come on, boy, come on, we're with you, boy. Hey, hey." And these people are sort of dragging around, and the band is playing String of Pearls. Think, 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 and they're moving back and forth, and they're having a sprint, see? And I thought a sprint, you know, you did something when you had a sprint. Well, they just moved a little faster in a sprint. Oh, they just drag around. And then at the end of the sprint, everybody throws nickels out there on the stage, and a guy walks around and picks them all up. And here is this guy. I'll tell you who the guy is. It's a wild moment. The guy who's doing all this, then there's an MC. The MC walks out there in the middle of the floor when things are cool and calm, when they're just dragging a little bit, and there's that big scoreboard. It says, "Now in its 1600th year, the fantastic Mickey Eisley Dance-a-thon." Mickey Eisley was the name of the guy who had the band. It was one way to get your band to work, you know. Gee, what a weird time. And so after the sprint, a guy would come out and he'd say, "Well, ladies and gentlemen, and now here he is. Here's the MC. Red is going to play and sing for you and give you a little, just a little entertainment while we're waiting for the next sprint to begin. So step up and let's hear it, Red." That was Mickey talking, see. And then this guy comes out and he starts doing the tap. "Hello, ladies and gentlemen. You know, funny thing happened to me coming down to the dance hall today. Now I'm going to do my famous imitation of Jimmy Stewart." And I'm watching this guy down there. And this went on for about 4 hours. And finally they took me home with smoke in my eyes, you know, feeling rotten. Well, I'll tell you who the guy was. Very weird thing. The guy who was the MC at the dance-a-thon that I saw later turned out to be Red Skelton. It was Red Skelton. So, I mean, you know, and I'm just a little kid. I'm this is going on and all business. And so...
That's what's made Winston the biggest selling filter cigarette in the country. And the reason for Winston flavor? Filter blend. Exclusive Winston tobaccos up ahead of the pure white filter.
I did that long ago. You just didn't hear it. See, you guys,
it all comes down to this. Flavor is what smoking is all about.
Is that what?
So get the filter cigarette.
That explains it all.
Full, rich tobacco flavor. Get Winston. Winston tastes good, like a cigarette should.
See, you were writing there, and you didn't hear me make the break. See what I mean? He heard it. He wasn't writing. What's the matter now? Don't I? Now, didn't you hear me make it? All right, then. Fine, good. Now, let's do a couple more here. MPY Valentine. You got a Valentine in there? Okay. All right.
To be Christmas.
This really moves the air, boy.
Crystal clear, the crystal refresher.
first swallow and everyone to follow proves Ballantine is the light beer with true lager flavor. Since 1840, America's finest.
There we go. And now let's see. Oh, yeah. Hey, listen, thinking of, oh, yeah. I don't know why. No, I don't, really. I don't know. I was fascinated. You know, I really believe that out of 10 people, just take 10 people at random, and if you were to ask these 10 people, of course, you hear it on the radio more than anything else. Almost every person who is on the radio, I find, these are the popular mediums, not radio alone, but television, and the popular magazines, have a set of beliefs that are immovable. Now, and they all believe the same thing. For example, just this is a very rough example. You can always trust a man who has a dog. You know, this kind of thing. Now that's a very rough example. Or things like this. Beatniks wear beards. This is the considered opinion of many of them. And then such things as, I believe that old people should move to Florida when they retire. Yes, sir. You know, this kind of thing, deep thinking. Things like, by George, I'll tell you what I think. I think that people should read better books. This sort of thing. Very, very deep sort of thing. Or, I think that movie producers have a great responsibility to the youth of the nation. The real, very deep things. And these are all thoughts which are held by all, of course the point is that none of them are thoughts at all. These are kind of cant. These are things that people say. Such things as, it's very important for many, many a marriage. You know, one of the things that holds a marriage together is children. This kind of thing. As a matter of fact, they refuse to concede that many a marriage has been broken up by children. But nevertheless, this is the kind of thing that's held. And these are very important beliefs that are held. Now, what I'm getting at is this, that you listen to one of these shows, or you listen to people talking like, and you know exactly what they're going to say on any given subject. So this is very soothing to large numbers of people who have no thoughts either, who only believe what they read at the bottom of calendars. And in fact, I had a very frightening call the other day that was not to me. And this is something that it should be, I'll just tell you what happened. You can put two and two together. I was in the office here, and there's a lot of telephones around, and I was in my office, as a matter of fact, and there's about 9 different people who occupy that office. Arlene Francis's secretary is in. It's a real menagerie. It's the one place where everybody in the station steers clear of. Ed and Peggy and Fitzgerald. By the way, I don't like to add fuel to a mounting controversy, but the Long John thing that John has been doing about Ed and Pagin is true. It's very difficult to accept truth in any shape or form. But Pagin comes in, and I'm in my office back, and it's a funny thing. I wish somebody would come in and record this. I think it's one of the most remarkable forensic tricks of our time, to hear Pagin in the next room warming up for her radio show. You know, she does both voices. She does the Ed Fitzgerald voice. And it's she can't get right into it at first. It takes her about 15 or 20 minutes. And the way she warms up is on the telephone. She makes phone calls in the Ed Fitzgerald voice. And the first 2 or 3 calls are very, you hear them. And she calls things like information at Grand Central and asks a question. And finally she works into it. And then you can hear it come. It really comes. And then about 3 minutes before the air, you know, she's ready for business. But nevertheless, it's a menagerie. This is a wild, swinging place. So the other day, a phone rang. Nobody's there on one of the desks, which I will not... It doesn't make any difference which one it was, seeing that the phone was ringing and ringing and ringing and ringing. The operators here have a theory that if you ring a phone long enough, somebody will have to answer. And it doesn't even make any difference who answers as long as it's, just ring, 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 ring. And so it's ringing and ringing and ringing. Obviously, no one is going to answer it who's official or who they want. So anyway, I finally picked the phone up. I said, hello. And there's this shrap-type lady on the other end of the line. Perfect voice. She goes, hello, hello. And I could tell it was an angry one. Hello, 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 hello. And I said, hello, may I help you, please? Yes, I would like to speak to Arlene Francis. I said, well, Miss Francis is on the air. I'm sorry. What do you mean she's on the air? She said, well, she's on radio now. Can you hear her? Yes, I'm listening to her. Would you please get her to the phone? She says, well, madam, how can she be talking to you on the telephone and doing a radio program?
What?
Well, how can she be talking to you and doing a radio program at the same time? She's on the radio.
What do you mean by that?
She's on the radio. You just said you heard her?
Yes, I'm listening to her. And I'd like to... Well, maybe you can help me. Why does Miss Francis lately... why does she insist on having controversial interviews?
Controversial interviews? What do you mean, controversial interviews?
Well, she's had these WOR used to be such a nice, friendly... A family station, and I love it so. But why does she insist on having these controversial interviews?
I said, well, what controversial interviews? Here she's just interviewing some poor guy who grows potted geraniums or something, and I'm listening to it. And I said, what are you talking about, madam? And the speaker is playing in the corner. And she goes on, she says,
well, I don't know why she insists on having controversial interviews.
Madam, may I ask you what you mean by controversial?
What did you say?
May I ask you what you mean by controversial?
You don't mean to tell me you believe the way she does, do you?
Madam, I don't believe any way. I'm merely asking you what you mean by controversial.
Well, thank you very much. I'm going to turn the station off and never listen again.
Oh. Well, apparently controversial means the way she doesn't think. Isn't it interesting that anything you disagree with is controversial and anything you agree with is right? It's fascinating. I'm sure that to Hitler, the subject of gas ovens wasn't controversial at all. Obviously. It's a very strange thing. It's an interesting phenomenon. And so I believe this, getting back to the subject of the discussion here, that there are a certain set of beliefs that are held by what appears to be the majority of the people. Now, these beliefs, invariably, I have found, are based almost totally on an emotional absorption of some kind of viscous fluid that the person grew up with. It has nothing to do with thinking. These are not thoughts, they're beliefs. Believe me, there's a great deal of difference between thought and belief. In case you're interested, look up idea and then look up belief. Two different things entirely. And so when somebody says, I believe so-and-so, that does not mean he has thought about it. Most people fight thinking tooth and nail because when you start thinking, then you run into all kinds of terrible deep shoals and dark waters where beyond which you have lack of knowledge, misinformation, plain stupidity, everything else starts getting in your way. So it's much easier to believe things. I believe so-and-so. That's all. Hardly anyone thinks past it. And interestingly enough, we even base a great deal of our testing systems on these beliefs. That a person who believes these things is generally considered by the people who do the testing, vocational testing and all that stuff, as a more stable person. And these are in capital letters. A person that is more fitted for the job, capital letters. Now, to give you an idea, a kid here says to me, he sent me a letter. I don't think I have enough time. How much time do I have? 259. Oh, well, that's all right. A kid sends me a letter, see, and he says, Shepherd, he says, I'm sitting in this idiotic high school out in the suburbs. And he says, and they believe in testing. Not testing you on your subjects, no. They believe on constantly testing you on your aptitudes and various things that they call your skills and abilities. These are all in capital. They never test me on arithmetic. They're always testing me on other things. And he says, and after you've taken about a dozen of these tests, you know the answers that they want. They're multiple choice questions like, what would you rather be? A streetcar conductor, an advertising executive, or a bum? And if you say streetcar conductor, obviously you're in the second rank already. And he says, you know, he says, and after a while you get so that you automatically can answer them all. You can either get 100 by answering them all. And if you answer them truthfully, he says, you're bound to be in trouble all the way down the line. And he says, I am sending you under separate cover an exact copy of one of the tests. He says, this is a test that has to do with vocations. He says, read these things and then think carefully about it. He says, here, for example, is one of the things they ask you. He says, you're supposed to say, which of these people do you like the most? Which do you dislike the most? Check the one that you would most rather be with, the people you'd most like. average, that's one type of person. Queer-looking people with unusual ideas. You notice they couple unusual ideas with queer-looking people? Queer-looking people with unusual ideas or carefree people. He says, obviously, you're supposed to underscore average. Carefree people are dangerous. Queer-looking people with unusual ideas. Oh, terrible stuff. And he says, what am I going to do? He says, I happen to like people with unusual ideas. He says, no. I know better than to underline that one. Just and they go on and then they ask me these questions like this, he says. Here, these are ideas for various jobs and so forth. He says, what would you rather do? Have friends? Have power? Have fame? Which would you underscore there? He says, well, everybody secretly wants power. That's what they want. He says, but you're supposed to underscore have friends. That's very important. He says, and everybody knows that that isn't what you want. And then there's another one. He says, what would you rather be? A piano tuner, a school teacher, or a dentist? Well, he says, half the kids I know would love to be a piano tuner. He says, I don't know one kid that would like to be a dentist. He says, most kids, a school teacher, maybe. He says, but what you're supposed to underscore is dentist. He says, he knows this. Work in a candy factory, keep bees, or give eye examinations. And so there's a whole series of things. And if you ask anyone these things, oh, speaking of a whole series of things, this is old Friendly Shepherd. I'll be back in 15 minutes following the news. We get this call from this friendly type school teacher. He said, well, Mr. Shepherd, the child should underline the things he really believes. No, madam, you've missed the point. The point of the discussion is he knows the things that he really believes, but he also knows another thing that all of us know, and that is that one is judged and graded by these tests. You are put in different categories, and that's in capital letters, and there are more desirable categories than others. Admitted, baby? We all know that some categories are preferred to others. What my young correspondent was saying is that everyone secretly knows the things you're supposed to answer to be put into the preferred categories. And if you deny this or argue with it, I refer you to a book by William White. Mr. White, who was one of the editors, I believe still is, one of the editors of Fortune magazine. What was the name of the book? Now, I wish I read the thing a couple of years ago, and it was an interesting sociological treatise on the business world today. Protestant by William White. Now, come on. It's in the same general category as the current popular socioeconomic books by Vance Packard, but this was far more scholarly and in many ways had more humor. Mr. Packard writes with no humor whatsoever. William White, what's the name of his book? It was a compilation of articles that ran in Fortune, and one of the chapters was on test passing. And he was saying, look, forget about the tests. His general attitude was, you know the correct answers that they want, the ones that they want you to answer. Regardless of what you believe, answer them. He says, because this is the way the system is. His general feeling was, if this is the system, and since it is the system, you have to work within it. And since you have to look out for your own leaky rowboat, answer these
questions this way, and he had a whole series of tests, the way that the categorizers wanted you to answer them, and almost all of them were completely based on a concept of bright, placid optimism and friendly mediocrity. And by the way, this is not a new thing. This is called generally putting up a front. And the putting up a front technique is as old as the hills, and it's only recently been codified and put into test form. As a matter of fact, the kid goes along and he includes a few more of the other questions. He says, get this one. What would you rather do? Advise people on personality improvement, catch rare animals, or cash checks? He says, as though they're all mutually independent. He says, I happen to know some people who would like to catch rare animals, also at times like to advise people on personality improvements, and they love cashing checks. He says, what a ridiculous question. He says, and as a matter of fact, most people who catch rare animals enjoy cashing checks inordinately. And he says, and he happens to know many people who advise people on personality improvements whose whole business is to cash checks. He says, now how are you going to answer that question? He says, so if I write cash checks down there, immediately I'm put into a second-rate category. He says, I know it. He says, if I put catch rare animals down there, he says, does that ignore the fact that I also like to tell people about their personality problems? He says, so which way do you go on these ridiculous questions? And then he listen to this one then. He says, listen to this one here. He says, now, what would you rather do? You're supposed to check the one you'd rather do. See, he says, belong to a discussion group for problems of modern life? He says, yeah, that's an interesting thought. Yeah, I think I would like to belong to a discussion group for modern life. Belong to a literary discussion group. Yeah, I'd like to do that, too. Belong to an astronomy club. Yeah. So I'd like to belong to all three of them. But I'm supposed to check the one I would like to belong to. He says, apparently they believe that people who are interested in astronomy are not interested in modern life, nor literary discussions. And conversely, people who are interested in literary discussions are not interested in modern life. He says that makes no sense whatsoever. He says it's totally nonsensical. And he says, and this is a test that was given in one of the big high schools in suburbia here. He says, and the kids are based on this. He says, all kinds of things are put in your record on the basis of this. Then he says, here's one here, he said. Now listen to this one. He says, this is a jazzy one. He says, choose which you prefer. Now listen. Put advertising circulars in cars passing a street corner. No, he says, I don't want to do that. Count cars going past the corner at different hours. No. Direct traffic at the street corner. No. I don't want to do any of them. He says, now what do you do? He says, I got to check the one I'd rather do. He says, do I want to stand out there and be a cop, direct traffic? No. He says, do I want to put ads in the cars? No. Do I want to count the cars? No. He says, now how am I going to check? He says, I got to check one. He says, and if you check none of them, it comes back and says, please check. You have missed one here. He says, and if you don't answer one, then you're put into a terrible category. Then you're really you're one of those odd-looking people going back to question seven, odd-looking people with unusual ideas. And you're one to watch. He says, it's like putting you between the devil and the deep blue sea half of the time. And the other time they say, which would you rather have? Would you rather be in love? Would you rather look at the stars? Would you rather drink a chocolate malt? He says, all three of them are great. He says, I'd like to, at any one given time. He says, people seem to, in these tests, have a single-mind attitude towards everything. Listen to this one, then. What would you rather do? write a newspaper column on current events, collect garbage, raise chickens. He says, it's obvious which one you're supposed to answer. he says, ridiculous stuff. He says, and serious people write these tests. And serious people grade you on these things. He says, it is a fantastic thing. Now, listen to this. Here's the one. You get a question of this one. Listen. Do you want to read about famous men and women? Read writers' descriptions of an ideal world. Read about the lives of early pioneers. He says, for one thing, he says, they have nothing in here about novels. He says, they don't even mention reading novels. He says, do I want to read about famous men and women? Yeah, sometimes, if it's well written. He says, do I want to read writers' descriptions of an ideal world? Yes, sometimes. except that many writers write descriptions of like, say, 1984. Or Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. How do you handle that one? He says, I happen to have liked that. He says, read about the lives of early pioneers sometimes. He says, now I'm supposed to check which one I want to read about. He says, now the idea, of course, is that he knows which one they want him to check to get into the right categories. Yes, would you like to catch rare animals or advise people on personality problems? Quick, come on, I want to answer, quick there. here's one. Now, here's another hard one to answer here. You're given a choice here. Work in a candy factory? He says, no, I have no desire to work in a candy factory. Keep bees? No, I don't want to keep bees. Give eye examinations? No! Now what do I answer? I don't want to do any of those. All right. And then he says, here's a doozy. He says, give this one to the average daily news reader. This is one from the field. Have friends, have power, have fame. He says, I want all three of them. Now what do you answer? It's oh, see, you notice they're all mutually exclusive, that if you have friends, you can't have power, nor fame. If you have power, you can't have fame or friends. And if you have fame, you can't have any of the others. He said, these things are like Alice in Wonderland. And the people seriously grade you on these. They're very serious. All right, children, today we're going to have a half day off. It's the PA system, you know, at 9 o'clock says, we are going to have a half day off. The senior class will be taking the aptitude tests, which are given bi-yearly. The senior class, section 2, will file into the auditorium at 10:17. The rest of you will stay in your study halls until the completion of the test, which will be at 11:45. At which time there will be a 5-minute intermission, and then section 1 will file in for their test. Section 2 will then return to their study halls after the completion of the test. We ask you, do not discuss the test with your neighbors. Do not discuss the test with your neighbors. That is all. This is Mr. Watanabe, the principal. And the very serious people are giving these serious things. Which would you rather do, old man? Come on. Come on, Harry, listen. Which would you rather do? Teach arithmetic? Teach dogs tricks? He says, I know an arithmetic teacher who has 3 dachshunds. He says, now, how's that guy going to answer that one? Or be the secretary of a congressman? He says, now, I suppose if you mark be the secretary of a congressman, that shows that you're interested in important affairs. And if you mark teach arithmetic, that means you're an intellectual. If you want to teach dogs tricks, slob. He says, I happen to know 2 congressmen secretaries who teach dogs tricks and who used to teach arithmetic. Oh, yeah, well, we've got an almost insane desire to categorize things. And I'll tell you how insane it is. That one of the big listings magazines, you know, that lists things in, for television viewing, do you know that they refused to list my television show for weeks on end for one reason? They wouldn't put it in. They would just say, to be announced. And the reason they wouldn't was because I refused to tell them a week in advance what I was going to talk about and the punchlines of all the gags that I was about to put on. Have you noticed whenever you look in one of these little TV things, it says, be sure to watch Loretta Young tonight. Bob Hope pays a surprise visit to her. Oh, boy, it's such a surprise. When Bob Hope pays a surprise visit, he comes in cleverly disguised as a Franciscan monk and completely fools Loretta Young. Now, after that, they are visited by her idiot cousin from Circleville, Ohio, who also is disguised, this time, as a good humor salesman. All the disguises are discovered in the last act, and Bob unveils himself as old Bob Hope, and everyone is surprised. It's such a surprise. Be sure to watch this surprise tonight. Well, I mean, are the people who read this thing, are they surprised then when it happens? You know, or else, have you ever noticed how they describe a movie? Jeffrey Lynn meets Priscilla Lane in this thrill-packed, wonderful movie that was given 2/3 of a star by the Daily News in 1938. Jeffrey Lynn is a test pilot, and for a long while it looks like Jeffrey Lynn is doomed.
However, there is a happy ending as the two of them finally make it in the last scene, and Jeffrey lands his battered Spad on the field, accompanied by the cheers of Barry Fitzgerald, her old elderly uncle who designed the airplane. What is this, you know? And we have an insane desire not only to know the answers before they're given, but also to categorize everything. And, of course, this is learned very early in school. I mean, kids are always asked to categorize things. Which do you like better, writing book reviews or standing on your head? It's kind of mutually exclusive, but nevertheless somehow coupled. And it's all part of the interesting tag thing. Tag. Put a tag on it. Put a tag on it. Believe me, you know why most of the comics who work on television and radio, why most of them have to have canned laughter? Is because if they didn't, people wouldn't know it's funny. They have to be told it's funny. And so if you were to see, let's say, the Danny Thomas show, have you ever wondered about these people that are doing family comedies and they're in their living room? I mean, they're in the kitchen, the living room, and you keep hearing people go, where are these people sitting, supposedly? In the bedroom, watching them, laughing? Well, the reason that they have to have the canned laughter is because the comic realizes that if he didn't have this, nobody would know what category to put him in. And if he's categorized as comic, then people will laugh. If he isn't, that's where my, you know, people never know. I get letters from people constantly, "Dear Mr. Shepherd, I have to tell you a terrible thing, but you know, the other day when you were talking, I had a laugh at what you had to say." And she's apologizing. Speaking of laughs, this is WORAM of FM New York. And we'll be here until 5 minutes to two, just before the opera. I see them all lining up across the street for the opera. Oh, listen. One of my favorite operas is being done tonight. I like Turandot. Turandot today, isn't it? Isn't it Turandot this afternoon? Well, this is not one of my particular favorites, but one of my real favorites is being done tonight at the Met, and I would love to go. This is Elektra. Strauss's Elektra. That is a wild opera. Beautiful opera. One of the greatest orchestrators of all time, and this man is one of the few people who wrote opera who really uses the orchestra with the total drama. Most operas seem to be accompanied by an orchestra, but boy, Strauss would never play the orchestra down. And it's a beautiful opera. And while we're on the The Organization Man, White's book. In case you're interested, any of you, dig up The Organization Man by William White of Fortune magazine. He has a whole chapter on passing tests based on pretty much the same things that we were saying here. While you're down there, I would suggest the Paper Book Gallery down in the Village. Now, I'm going to tell you something about the gallery. Speaking of adult education, I wanted to read an essay. I did not pick this up at the Paper Book Gallery, in case you're interested. I've probably got, next to S.J. Perlman, the greatest collection of paper books assembled this side of a paper book warehouse. I'm a compulsive buyer of the darn things, and it gets expensive and lumpy. But a long time ago, I picked up a copy. Now, wait a minute. Just hold on here. A beautiful little book of essays by one of the truly interesting people in the world, Aldous Huxley, who wrote Brave New World and Point and Counterpoint and a lot of very interesting things. And his everything he writes has a viewpoint. And one thing it has shot through his writing is an intense interest in life, everything in life. And he wrote a little description of what an essay is. Look, I'm not going to tell you any more about it, except to say this, that if you're going to start an adult education scheme to educate yourself away from the editorial writers, I would suggest you pick up a copy of the collected essays of Aldous Huxley. I can't give you the publisher, but it's a paper book just called Collected Essays, Aldous Huxley, and some of them are magnificent. And this is the thing, if you're down at the paper book gallery, look for it. The Collected Essays of Aldous Huxley, one of my favorite pieces of paper-bound material. I've really enjoyed it. And the next thing that I would recommend, not for knowledge but wisdom, two different things. Not for knowledge but wisdom. This is the
translation of a 12th century bestiary by T.H. White. I think White is a remarkable author. And on my night show, Jan, on my night show, beginning this coming week, I'm going to read a few selected things from one of the most beautiful little books. You know, it's a true underground book. If you're interested in an underground book, I don't even know whether you can get copies of it or not. I just don't know whether you can get copies of it or not. This is one of the few books that I've read in a long time. You know, I'm getting a little tired of the hip children's books. You know, the right things to read, the Poohs and the Dr. Seusses and these are all fine. But it seems to me that some of the best things that have been written for children, not only entertain children, but do much more than that. And one of the most beautiful little books I've ever read for children. It's really not for children, but it is and it isn't. And what I'm saying is that I do not like books that are written for adults, but have the outward trappings of a child's book. That covers the best of two possible worlds. It really hits the childish adult right where he lives, is what it does. But this is a magnificent little book that is not written for anybody. And because it isn't written for anybody, is good for everybody. You know what I mean? Kids dig it and people dig it. It's a book called Mistress Masham's Repose. Mistress Masham's Repose by T.H. White. One of the first things I ever read by White. White is the guy who wrote The Once and Future King. And there's a lot of that wonderful wisdom and just a blinding love for humanity and the fact of life itself that comes through this man's writing. If he never writes another word again, I'll say that here is one man who loved being alive and who loved people more than anything else. And don't give me don't start whipping up the flag of Norman Vincent Peale. This is another thing entirely. Mistress Masham's Repose. And if you're going down, look for it in the gallery. I don't know whether they have it or not down there. This is purely a guess. I don't know. But the paper book gallery will be open till 2 tonight. They're down on the square, Sheridan Square. And they're over on 6th Avenue. Oh, incidentally, speaking of the paper book gallery, on 6th Avenue at 8th Street, you know, you just take the 6th Avenue subway right down to the 4th Street sub, you know, where it says New York University stop, 4th Street. Just get off, go upstairs, and you'll find you're on 6th Avenue. And right at the corner of 6th Avenue and 8th Street, right in that whole area, you'll find the Paper Book Gallery. And right next to the Paper Book Gallery, opened its doors officially this morning at 7 a.m., is a brand new Prexy. I've been eating in Prexy's for years. And let me tell you something about Prexy's. They have the best little salad for a quarter I ever run into anywhere. Magnificent little salad. And one of the few hamburgers that literally fights back. And great, great French fries. But this is all beside the point. As you have noted, this is the hamburger with the college education, which sounds like most people I know with a college education. Now listen, there is a new Prexy's. This is opening at 6 and 8. And today only, just today, they'll be open until about 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning. Anyone who goes in and gives the password, they're not giving it to anyone else. This is a fact. And do it quietly. Just say, Excelsior. They will bring you out a strawberry shortcake with ripe, fresh strawberries poured over it and covered with a great big gob of soft ice cream. Have you ever had Prexy's soft ice cream? This is real ice cream. This is not frozen custard, any of that jazz. It is fantastic, and it is on the house today only. And immediately after the show, I'm going to mosey down and say Excelsior. I'm taking you down there, Jan. I hope you haven't eaten for a week. Any of you people, I'll tell you this, any of you people who are living on a 900 calorie diet, you know, that can be very inconvenient, you know. This 900 calorie, I suggest you do this. Come on down to Prexy's today, say Excelsior. Down this strawberry shortcake and you won't have to do it for the rest of the week. You're through eating for the rest of the week. It'll carry you all through. 900, you know. Which would you rather do? Hang by your feet, eat strawberry shortcake, or holler whoopee? Now, come on, give me the answer there. We're going to put you in a category, kid. I remember, Trexie's on 6th Avenue at 8th Street. It's the new one. Well, I don't know, you know. Oh, yes, we have another one here. We got right down there, right across from the other paper book gallery, which is on Sheridan Square, is the Pottery of All Nations. Do you know what happened to me the other day? Did I tell you on the air about the guy who sent me the Okinawan mugs from, well, all right. I don't know what to say about this, but there's a girl who works for me. And she did it. You know what she didn't even say I'm sorry. How do you like that? She takes my Okinawan mug, which I had never used. I had used it once. I had guests in my office, and I had coffee put in one of them. And this mug was in my desk, and she takes the mug out, immediately drops it. Pow! Busted Okinawan mug. I've got one Okinawan mug now, which was sent to me from Okinawa. And today, Jimmy, with a production supervisor here, comes up to me and he says, get me some Okinawan mugs. They're beautiful. I don't think they have any anymore. I know they don't have any down at the Pottery of All Nations. Or do they have some now? I don't know. But if you don't know about the Pottery of All Nations, doesn't it irritate you when you lose something? I mean, something that, you know, it just would just... what a frustrating feeling. You know that I went all over Europe the last time I was in Europe, and I had a big sketch pad filled with sketches. And I had sketches of Rome, I had sketches of Frankfurt and Munich, and sketches of Austria, and a lot of Roman sketches. And I had worked awfully hard, and the last day I was on my way back, I arrived in Munich, I was going to catch the plane the next morning for Frankfurt, and then from Frankfurt in to New York. The last day I left my sketch pad on a bus in Bavaria. I never got it back. And you know that thing rankles me yet? If I had it, I probably would have the sketch pad stuck under a lot of stuff, but I still remember. Every time I see my new sketch pads now, I get mad. Something irritating. And you know that I have almost stopped drawing since that? Just a fantastic, I don't know, it's a kind of a intense disappointment. And for some reason or other, that busted Okinawan mug became 50 times more important to me when it was broken. And I have it in my desk now, busted. Huh? Oh, I'll fix it. I'm going to glue it together and all that stuff. But it still is broken, you know? But if you're going down to the Pottery of All Nations, tell them to please try to get me an Okinawan mug. They are magnificent. And if you don't know about the Pottery of All Nations, this is a wonderful place. It's a place, if you're going to make the village scene, just to spend about 2 hours. And by the way, they always keep the coffee on. You can have a cup of coffee while you're there and fool around and look at the Italian tiles and the German pottery and the Danish flatware and all this stuff. And it's all on rough wooden shelves, you know. Nobody, people walk around and kids cry and old ladies push each other. You know, you can hide for weeks in the back there. They have a lamp section. These old Italian ceramic lamps and all that, all piled up and great big gargoyles and stuff. You can stand around back there and sniff, weep a little bit, and drink your coffee, and get away from, you know. It's the Pottery of All Nations, who have never been known to pluck at anybody's sleeve. And they have the stuff now. And by the way, their prices are amazing. They have another store over at 64th and Lex on the east side. They're open also till 10. And a beautiful one across the river in New Jersey for the exiles. In Paramus on Route 4, the Pottery of All Nations, and the coffee pot is always hot in all the stores. Now, one more note here. No notes at all. I keep thinking whether I'd like to put ads in a car or count the number of cars going past or be a bum. I think I'll pick being a bum, actually. How about this one? He says, here's one for you to stick in your hollow tooth. Write a history of the Red Cross. How would you like to write a history of the Red Cross? Write a history of the Red Cross. Search for information to shed new light on a famous historical event. All capitalized. Or write a musical comedy. He says, look, Dad, let's level. Half of the guys who write histories of the Red Cross secretly would love to be able to write a musical. He says, and half the guys who do write informations on new lights on famous historical events are doing it hoping that someone will make it into a musical. He says, what is this, you know? He says, as a matter of fact, I don't want to write any one of those. I would prefer to write a novel, which I'm working on now. He said, and they didn't have anything down there about novels. It's always write a thing about an event or a famous person. Nobody talks about it. Write poetry? No, that never enters it. That's classified with odd-looking people with strange ideas of poetry. Thought you might like to... This is a kind of nice choice here. Don, which would you rather be? Be the most successful tractor salesman in the country, be a certified public accountant, or be an authority on taxation? Oh, what a dull choice. All three of them you want to be? I can't stand any of them. How would you like to be an authority on taxation? Ugh. Taxes, schmaxes. Oy. Like my mother used to say, looking out over the window through her potted geraniums, she'd see old Bruner staggering up on Saturday night with a snoot full, catching his neck on the clothesline as he goes in. He finally falls through the screen door, and she says, death and taxes and Bruner on Saturday night. I'd say, Mom, what do you mean, death and taxes and Bruner? She says, when you grow up, you'll know. Well, to be honest with you, Ma, I never have found out. I mean, it is all a giant conjecture. Which would you rather be most? Come on, you residents of Queens. Your kids are being asked this. Would you rather be the most successful tractor salesman in the world? Of course, you're supposed to say no to that one. I mean, you know, this is slobism, apparently. You notice they don't say be the most successful Ford salesman? Because most of the kids will grow up to be that. It's a tractor salesman, the most successful tractor salesman in the country. Be a certified public accountant. Now, that's very respectable. Yes. Be an authority on taxation. Very respectable. They don't say be a trapeze artist. You know? Never anything. Oh, no wonder guys who go into the arts feel terrible. But do you know that almost every artist I know has a deep sense of guilt because in America, artists are never classified on any kind of, never. They never put them down on any of these things as having a legitimate vocation. This is like things you play with, you know, like cutting out paper dolls and fooling around. Oh, they should do. They should work as an artist for a while. Ooh. I mean, it's a lot more than the romantic life in the loft, you know, I can tell you that. And there are many people who are, and I'm not talking about illustrators who illustrate Saturday Evening Post short stories, not what we're talking about. One of my friends, for example, is a successful artist, a really successful fine artist, Dong Kingman. And Dong says that every time he goes out to sketch, now this man has earned his living as a fine artist for years, and every time he goes out to sketch, somebody comes around and stands and looks over his shoulder. And he says, pretty soon, they'll say, you draw? Here he's sketching away. And he says, yes, I do. Well, I draw too. Okay. Dog doesn't say anything. Then there's another long pause. And then he says, finally, he says, what do you do for, do you work? What do you do for a job? He says, well, I'm working right here. You know, I work 29 hours a day at this. Oh. And the guy walks, there's a bum. He works 4 hours a day at his job, and his union makes it possible for him to stand around for the other four. And he thinks that an artist is a fool and a charlatan, a bum, and a fraud. Believe me, no artist is allowed to stand around, because when you see those pictures hanging on the gallery, somebody had to paint them. And there ain't no union for painters. No 10-minute breaks on the hour, every hour, every... It just doesn't work that way. No scale at all, no. And they're not even allowed, as far as I know, they don't even come under Social Security. You know? But nevertheless, they're very important people. The most important, probably, that we have. And that includes the whole crew. Now, so what would you rather do? Advise people on personality improvement? Hey, you... You lady out in Staten Island, I'm sure she knows which one she'd rather do.
Yes, I like to tell people about their personality problems, of course. But then, on the other hand, I've caught several rare animals in my time. You know, I've been married twice. And cash checks, yes, I love cashing checks. Now that you ask the question, I can't tell really which I'd prefer to do. Depends on the time of day. Yes, Mr. Shepherd, you are the one.
Yes. Speaking of art, I think that every American knows it to himself and knows something about art. You mean, oh, what a cliche. I don't believe that. Stop it, Shepherd, I don't. Now, cut it out. Why did you say that? There comes the old clichésville again. No. Let's put it on this basis. If you think you should know something about art, and particularly American art, you should know about the... Come on, put the thing up there. What? Are you, no, don't take it down. Leave it up there. No. See, you took the sign down. Put it up again. There you go. There. That makes me feel a little more secure. You should know something about the Art Students League. And the Art Students League is one of the real bulwarks of American art. More artists than I know of. By the way, Dong is one of the people who taught there some time ago. I don't think he studied there. I think he taught there at one time. All sorts of interesting people teach at the Art Students League. People like Marius Cooper, a superb watercolorist, incidentally. And if you are interested in knowing something about American art in particular, which incidentally is the leading school today in the world, if you can classify a nation's art output as a school, that something in the American air in the last 5 or 6 years has galvanized our artists to become the kind of spearhead of what is, you know, at any given time in history, one nation is producing the people who are influencing most of the other artists in the world. Now, this is either for good or bad. We're not here to describe or to make any value judgments on it. This is a fact that at one time it was the French artist. At another time it was the German artist. Of course, there was a period of time when the Spanish, these were going back in history now. The most recent big influences, of course, were the French around the turn of the century all the way on up into the 20s. And then gradually, in the 30s, the American artist began to be a world power. A lot of important people grew to maturity in that period, and even to this day, although there are some signs that it is beginning to taper off, the American artist is the galvanizing factor in world art, that their paintings are examined and understood and rejected or accepted by the world's artists. They are, in a sense, the ferment. They're the seed around which artistic ferment is boiling today. And many of these people came out of the Art Students League. And if you would like to know something about this organization, they would be more than pleased to send you a big booklet. It's about an 80 or 85 page book, and it contains all kinds of illustrations, pictures, and reproductions of the work of the people who teach there. As well, and incidentally, you can only judge. See, one of the things that's interesting about the Art Students League, and I speak here as an amateur painter and drawer, is that you select the man you want to work with merely by the work that he does. And working with a teacher in any one of the arts is a very difficult proposition. You cannot be taught talent, you know, get it out of your head. This business, you know, with a match covers, you too can learn it. Yeah, you can learn to draw, but that doesn't mean you have talent. You can't learn it. And working with talent is a very difficult thing. And the Art Students League has a wide selection of people who are really experienced teachers, and all of them are excellent, well-known, and understood painters. So if you'd be interested in getting one of these booklets, just send your name and address to Art Students League in care of Gene Shepherd, W.O.R., New York, New York. And nobody's going to be pounding on you. This is purely educational. They're not going to try to sell you any courses, any of this nature. If you want to take them, of course, they'd love to have you. But no one's going to be banging on your doors. Ah, it's time for your life class, Fred. Although that wouldn't be bad either. I know some people who can take some classes in life. Arts Students League, Gene Shepherd, W.O.R., New York, New York. And they'll send the thing out to you. No cost. Very few things are no cost. Now, I'm going to ask you some more questions here that you might find difficult to answer. Let's see. Would you rather be an authority on contract bridge, an authority on soil erosion, or an authority on billboard advertising? Now, that'll hang you up for a while. Kid says, I hate card games. He says, I don't know what soil erosion is. He says, some billboards hurt my eyes. I never was a sociable. But you have to make the choice, because if you leave all of them blank, you are obviously one of those odd people with strange ideas. Either that, or you're way down at the bottom of the class of the group that can't read. whereas actually the fact is you can read too well. I mean, come on, stand up. It's your knees first that get it, man. Oh, yes, tonight I'm going to be on the Long John show. I'm going to be on the Long John show from midnight all the way all through the night. Oh, this is the kind of show that makes it. I mean, no time limitations, nothing but toil and trouble, boil and bubble. And while you're thinking that over, friends, I hope that by next Monday night you'll have an answer for me. Whether you want to teach contract bridge, whether you want to teach soil erosion or billboard advertising, or perhaps whether you'd like to have friends, have power, or have fame. Choose these things and think them over very carefully, because you're liable to be judged for the rest of your life on them. You're liable to be put in a category. But yet, on the other hand, everyone wants to be put in a category if they can. So be the first in your neighborhood to have a real big title, a tag underneath you. A friendly man lives here in this house. Friendly, reliable, and one that you can trust. And by the way, he's got his 2 feet on the ground. He's picked all the right categories.